Hello and welcome to React Native Radio. I'm your host, Nader Davitt. Today on our panel, we have Mike Grabowski.
Hello, everyone.
And our special guest today is Radek Petrushevsky. And I mispronounced his last name, but maybe he can do better. Welcome to the show, Radek.
Hi. Thanks very much for inviting me. Yeah, it's Petrushevsky, but that's really, really close. It's much better than most attempts.
Okay, cool. Awesome. Yeah, so why don't you give us an introduction? Tell us about yourself.
All right, so I'm Radek, Auric at Nozbe, which is a Polish company, and we make this app called Also Nozbe, which helps people and teams organize their work. And I do mostly React Native and React work these days for Nozbe, and also anything related to native iOS platform stuff, you know, iOS, Mac, Swift, and whatnot. I do that. So, yeah.
So, I know you are originally a native iOS developer, because the first time we met, you were wearing a pretty badass Swift t-shirt. That was at the React Native meetup. So, you know, there's a lot of people saying that iOS developers hate React Native and vice versa. So maybe you could relate to that, because you are one of the developers that I know that did this shift. And what sort of made you to consider React Native in particular as a next technology of your choice?
Right. So before doing React Native, I also worked at Nozbe doing iOS work. So the reason why I'm doing React Native is because we're, you know, continue to progress with our app and technologies and, you know, a secret project that's going on right now. And considering available technologies for what we needed, and what we needed is to have an app that just works everywhere in a small team, then we concluded that going all in with React on the web and React Native for iOS and Android, and then sharing as much code as possible, is simply the best available option on the market, so to speak, right now. And but for me personally, what's exciting about React, the development paradigm, like how you can express things as sort of pure functions of data, like, you know, things just flow automatically. They're just like working with React and React Native is so much more pleasant than UIKit on iOS most of the time. And then I think it's much better, like, if you already know JavaScript, and, you know, I already knew JavaScript and knew, you know, UIKit, Swift, Objective-C, then it's sort of best of both worlds, because a lot of downsides, a lot of problems with React Native, you know, stem from the fact that it just doesn't look as good or doesn't work as fast. And when you have a little bit of deeper knowledge about the inner workings, then it's easier to like plug in something from the native world to troubleshoot problems. And then like, and then a lot of the complaints that people have from a native iOS community just don't apply, because you can deal with them. And, you know, it's not 100% perfect, but it's still like best choice for many teams and many projects.
All right. Yeah. So how does the adoption at Nozbe of React Native looks like? Were you able to convince your friends by selling them those React Native features as something, you know, as an advantage over regular development?
Okay. So this is a tricky question, because we haven't shipped anything using React Native at Nozbe yet. We're using React and React Native for a new project, which is not out yet. And like beginning on it, like we just decided on the technology stack from the beginning, and we decided that this is it. And before that, like all that's shipped currently is essentially a web app. Like it's based on Cordova on Android and iOS, just with a lot more native hacking so that it works much better. So we're already in sort of in JavaScript camp. And so going to React Native was more about pulling people up to deal with native code, rather than telling quote unquote regress to the ugly JavaScript code. Like, I didn't have to deal with that. That would be a difficult thing to sell.
Oh wow, that's good. That's gonna be quite the upgrade from Cordova, I would say. So I guess that brings us to the main topic of the recording. Was the WatermelonDB, which is the project you started, something that, you know, sort of started as development internally at Nozbe because you were not able to satisfy all the use cases you had with React Native as a part of your internal project? Or was it something totally independent from what you are doing right now?
Yeah, Watermelon is something that came to be as part of this project that we're working on. And this is exactly right. We looked around at possible options of, you know, database/data persistence solutions for React and React Native apps. And, you know, we had many requirements, which are like some of the combination of all of those requirements is pretty niche, but very important to us. And we just haven't found anything that satisfied all of those requirements. And that's why we started building Watermelon, and it started just as a proof of concept. And then it sort of got out of hand, and it, you know, began growing into this whole thing, this whole sort of database framework solution.
So can you talk about Watermelon DB exactly? Like, why would someone use it, what it does, and kind of what other options there are for similar things, I guess? Like, what category does it fall in?
Right. So this is sort of, Watermelon is essentially like a full stack, meaning React Native, iOS, Android, and web browser for React, database framework solution kind of thing. So it does a couple of things. One thing we need is a local database that works offline. That's a thing we need. We need to be able to share it, like share the same code between React Native and the browser, which disqualifies something like Realm, which on the web is, you know, it's an online GraphQL solution, but not Realm, the database. It has to scale to a relatively, you know, big sizes for a mobile app. So tens of thousands of records, you know, 20, 50, 100 megabyte databases. It has to be syncable. So you have to be able to plug in a backend server and like synchronize data, resolve conflicts, and it has to be fast. And in particular, when talking about fast, I mean, the app has to launch fast. Like, that was one of the problems we've encountered trying out different things in React Native, which is that the vast majority of solutions for just, you know, storing data and dealing with user data for React Native works by loading everything at app launch to memory, to JavaScript world. And when you have like, you know, 10,000 objects, then that's just too slow. The performance of the React Native bridge and like a couple of other bottlenecks just makes it impossible to do it this way. You have to be able to load everything lazily when you need it, so that even when you have a lot of data in your app, so, you know, think when you have a to-do app, like in an app like Nosby, you might have dozens of projects, and in each one of them, you can have dozens of tasks, and in each one of them, you can have dozens of comments, and that's 10,000 objects already, right? But on one screen, you might only need like 40 pieces of data. So you only need to load that. And then, like, how do you do that? So one solution that I often see people do in React and React Native is to use, you know, an object store that they use for state management, so Redux, MobX, something like that, and then add a persistence adapter to just like dump everything to disk and load it at launch. And again, that's not fast enough. Some people in React Native just going to use async storage, but that doesn't scale. Like, it's very limited and it's not a database. Like, it's not very good. And then you can use something like SQLite, like a you know, just a raw SQLite adapter on React Native. But it has a couple of problems. First of all, you can't share it with the web. So you need some sort of abstraction layer on top of that. And second of all, if you just use raw SQLite to fetch data, then it's not observable, right? So you want to just connect queries and records to like lists and components, and then you want them to refresh automatically when the source of data changes, right? And when you use SQLite directly, then you can't do that. So Watermelon is an abstraction over that. So it does use SQLite under the hood for React Native, and it uses Locky.js on the web, but then it's a reactive, observable abstraction on top of that. So you can just define connections between the database, the data, and components, and they will automatically re-render when it's needed. And because on React Native, all of this stuff is loaded lazily, like you only load stuff you need to render the components you have on screen, then you can easily scale to tens of thousands of records, you know, dozens of megabytes. And even on, you know, slow Android devices, this is still fast. Like the bottleneck is going to be rendering and not the database.
Wow, that's really interesting. I have a lot of questions, but I guess the first question is, so if it's an implementation of SQLite or something like that, I think you mentioned, if you have a data source, does it have to be a certain type of data source for your backend for it to work properly as far as it being SQL or NoSQL, or will it work with pretty much any data source?
So the way Watermelon works is you have adapters. So there are two adapters that come out of, like, you know, the work out of the box. For React Native, for iOS and Android, there's a SQLite adapter. So if you just, you know, yarn add WatermelonDB to a React Native app, it's just going to work, right? Like SQLite is like bundled and hooked up to Watermelon. And on the web, like there's another adapter for the web, and that's going to work too. But you could conceivably hook up any underlying sort of raw database underneath Watermelon. There's like an adapter interface, and if you can find a record by ID, if you can create, update, delete, and if you can query and sort of change Watermelon's query format to whatever you need, then you can plug in anything. And since it's asynchronous, like you could do some pretty crazy things in principle. You could connect it to some remote source even, though I wouldn't recommend that. Like you could do anything with it.
So how's the adapter interface implement designed in particular? What I'm really interested to understand is the reactiveness of the Watermelon DB, mm-hmm. because I just had a quick look at the project's README where it says that whenever the update happens in any other instance of the app, you will get the update immediately. So, like, I'm not aware of SQLite being sort of reactive or having a update mechanism. So, I just like to understand, like, how does the reactive layer is implemented on top of the database engine? So that, let's say, if I have a file source or remote source, how would I deliver those updates? And whether it's, you know, efficient or what's the cost overall of that update for the network?
All right. So there's a couple of things here. There's observability and there's syncability. So observability is how you plug in data into components, and the components in React just re-render automatically when the data changes. But this is observing the local database, the Watermelon copy of whatever have you have in the app. So it's not like it observes some, you know, like some different copy of the app. That's another thing. So for observability, like when you have your app, notice that like all changes, all writes to the database will come from JavaScript. So if you, again, you have a to-do app, right? And you add a task, then it might require like multiple changes to occur in the app. Like you might need to re-render the list, you might need to re-render some counters, like you might need to render a lot of things, and that will happen automatically. But because the changes originate from JavaScript, Watermelon can just figure out where, like which queries depend on this change that you're just making. So all of the observability is in the JavaScript realm. And so the adapter interface is purely imperative. It's not reactive. The Watermelon API is the reactive layer on top of that. And, you know, that's sort of how it works. And because the figuring out of the queries that need to update and the components that need to update happened like directly, like when you change something, then it's the overhead of that is pretty small. Like I haven't measured the exact numbers, but it's not a big deal. And then as far as synchronizing multiple instances, then that's something that needs a little bit more work to document exactly how to plug into the synchronization part. But Watermelon tracks changes to objects that you make. So when you add an object or change it or delete it, Watermelon will track which records were changed how. And then you can plug in like arbitrary sync engine. You can just plug in your own web server, whatever it is, and just, you know, pull from Watermelon, hey, here's the changes that occurred. You can push them to the server so that you update the source of truth in the server, and you can pull the changes from the server and apply it to the local copy. And yeah, that part needs documenting. So my bad, like this is still, this just been open sourced a couple of weeks ago. But yeah.
All right. Thanks for this explanation. So following this further a bit more, how is that implemented on the JavaScript side? Like, let's say I have five components and each of them is subscribing to like a value in my database, and that value changes over time. So is the update optimized in any way? Like you batch them and render from the top only once, or will the rendering happen like each once for each of the components? How's that implemented under the hood?
Okay, so you're asking about how components update when the data changes, correct?
Yeah, mm-hmm, exactly.
Okay. So what we do right now is there's a higher order component called observables because Watermelon exposes for observing changes to queries. So when you do some lists that belong to a project or that have some specific attributes, and you then Watermelon exposes an RxJS observable as the object that changes over time. And then we made this hook with observables that you wrap a component with, and you plug in this observable. And so when a change to this list is detected, then Watermelon will emit a new change on this observable, and the higher component will get the data that's now changed, the new list, and we render the component. And for re-rendering like one piece of data, so you have a task component, for example, and you just want to observe changes to this task, then you just, again, observe the task record directly, plug it into the component with a higher component, and when a change occurs, it just, the higher component injects the prop with the new version of the record to re-render. In the future, we could do it even smoother and better, but we're waiting for the React Suspense API to make it better because Watermelon is asynchronous, which is a little bit challenging with React right now, but it's going to get better with Suspense.
All right. Thank you very much for explaining this.
So I'm kind of curious, is the implementation restrictive to something like using GraphQL? Because I know a lot of people are working with GraphQL these days, and I know with mobile in general, offline seems to be a really important thing for certain applications. Does this work with GraphQL?
Right. So we don't like. There's nothing specific to GraphQL or anything like that in Watermelon. We don't use GraphQL at Nosby, and so like in terms of how you use Watermelon on the local side, like there's nothing there. And in terms of having a backend for the data and pulling data from it, then it doesn't matter. Like Watermelon is about synchronizing the whole database. Like that's the sort of use case it's built for. It's not about pulling data online and just like caching bits of it. It's about having a full local database. So for synchronization, like you really don't need a querying language like GraphQL because you really just need to be able to pull like with one endpoint a list of changes and push the list of local changes back to the server to synchronize them. And the way you implement it is out of like Watermelon doesn't care. Watermelon is a local database only. And again, with a tiny bit better documentation, it just exposes an API to plug in whatever way of synchronizing you prefer.
Okay, that makes sense. So when you're sending data, I guess, to your data source, is WatermelonDB basically like the intermediate layer, or do you send a so for instance, you make a post to your API, do you send the data to Watermelon and then Watermelon sends it to the database, or do you have to make two requests or two API calls for this to actually happen?
Right. So Watermelon is the API layer that you use for all communications with the data. That's just your local database, right? So when using Watermelon, you're not going to pull data directly from the underlying database like SQLite. Like Watermelon is an abstraction layer on top of that. So when you synchronize, you just use a Watermelon API call to get the data, and it goes over the JavaScript to native bridge. But you know, that's really just an implementation detail. Like when you use Watermelon, you just use Watermelon APIs to get the data. You push it to the server whatever you way you want. Or when you want to synchronize data from the server, you get the data and you make a batch call to insert all of the changes to Watermelon.
So as far as the offline piece is concerned, we've at AWS we built an offline library for GraphQL specifically, and it's been really interesting working with it because we have it working on the web and also on React Native, and we've noticed that we've run into a lot of issues with Android as far as memory consumption and just performance in general. I'm just kind of curious as far as like when you all implemented this, like what technical difficulties were the hardest things to kind of overcome?
Definitely performance. So this is challenging in React Native in general, right? So that's one of the reasons why the primary reason the Watermelon exists is for performance, that we can't like pull everything at launch. And so everything is lazy loaded, but then there's a ton of other sort of performance tricks to avoid doing recomputations and to do things more efficiently and really just optimize for just performance quirks of React Native. And Android has been a little challenging too. The biggest challenge in terms of performance is the bridge. Like that's really the big thing. And this is getting better soon-ish in React Native. So I'm really excited about that because that's, especially on Android, that's the biggest bottleneck. It's the bridge. So that's one thing. And as for just the implementation of Watermelon, one of the challenges is that it's all asynchronous. It's all async APIs. So you're really going to use that with async await APIs to make it nice to use. And asynchronicity makes things really weird and interesting when you talk about databases, because you have to ensure that everything is consistent, that when you make multiple changes to the database, that they happen at the same time, that you don't have multiple sort of pieces of your code trying to modify different things at the same time. So there's been a bunch of just engineering and testing and figuring things out to make sure that we can be fully asynchronous, which makes a lot of like which is necessary for React Native because of the way Bridge works, and which is very gives a lot of opportunities in terms of optimizations, because on the web we can pull like we can push the whole database processing to a web worker, and just makes a lot of potential things possible, but it's tricky. It's difficult to design a database API that works and that's not going to shoot you in the foot, that's fully asynchronous. So the engineering for that was one of the biggest challenges.
And I see that you use RxJS as far as maybe you're using that for the streaming stuff. Like how I'm just kind of interested because I've been trying to learn RxJS. How hard is it to learn RxJS as far as you've probably done some really sophisticated things with it? For people that are listening that are looking to get into reactive programming with Rx, do you have any pointers?
That's a good question. So reactive programming is like it's one of those things like, functional programming has been getting very popular as a thing in the last couple of years. And it's the sort of thing that when you first see examples of it, it sort of tries to break your brain and you don't understand what's going on and it's weird and you don't understand why you have to learn this and it's just odd. But it's just one of those things that when you spend some time learning it and like putting things together, it starts making a ton of sense. So as far as Watermelon is concerned, RxJS is mostly an implementation detail. If you know RxJS, you can do some really fun stuff to make things easier for you, but you don't have to know RxJS to use Watermelon. But if you'd like to learn it, then I wish I had specific links to it, but definitely look up marble diagrams. There's a lot of websites that try to explain how Rx works in terms of these marble diagrams, which is a really good way of visualizing flows of data over time or changes of data over time. And observables are very useful for when you have like very asynchronous things, when you have like multiple streams of data that change over time. And an observable is just a very good way of encapsulating that. When you have a synchronous architecture of whatever complex thing you're building, then you don't really have to care. But when you have something that's non-trivial, that changes over time, and when you have like different transformations of that async data over time, then when you try to just like pull data using promises and then like callbacks to do some transformations and stuff, you're just going to go into a big spaghetti code that you can't figure out. And observables are like, you have to pay the price of learning it at first, but then you have this really nice, really clean API for abstracting, you know, async changes over time. And you can do very complex things that are simple and easy to figure out once you've learned the basics. So definitely look up marble diagrams, and there's some really good tutorials to familiarize yourselves with the basic concepts.
So for people that would like to get started playing around with this, maybe using it, can you give a couple of good use cases and then B, like where they would go to learn how to use it? Maybe the GitHub repo or something?
Yeah, sure. So as for use cases, Watermelon is going to be great if you build something that has to work offline, that you synchronize, that you scale to larger sizes. And like especially if you want to synchronize between React Native and the browser, then you might not have that many great options. For React Native only, Realm would be something of a competitor to Watermelon. But if you want React Native and web, Watermelon is one of few reasonable options. And then with the other requirements, and as far as I know, that's the only one. And like really, if you're building an app that has that deals with user data, like a couple of examples I've given on the React Native EU presentation where like if you have an app for managing, I don't know, like a list of articles you want to read, or something like a to-do app, project management app, some sort of financial management app, or a notes app, like when you have user data and there might be a lot of it and it has to work offline, then you need a database, and Watermelon might be a good fit for you. And the details for that are on github.com/nosby/watermelondb. And there's the documentation for it, the guide on how to get started, and a tiny, like very oversimplified demo project. And so you can check it out there.
Is there anything else you wanted to discuss before we wrap it up and jump to the picks?
No, maybe I shouldn't go into that rabbit hole, but I really wish more people were really sharing code between React Native and React. Like when embarking on this product we're working on, we felt like, you know, it's called React and React Native, it's so similar. So like surely there's a lot of people, a lot of companies that build apps that share component level code between the two platforms. But it turns out very few people do. And when you want to make an app that shares between iOS, Android and the web, and they're not completely different apps, it's the web app is a full app, not just a toy app, then there will be some challenges. And Watermelon is one of the products of those challenges. Like we couldn't figure it out any other way. We had to build this. And there's a couple of other things we're going to open source that we also had to do along the way to make this possible. So I wish more people did this and built open source tools to help smooth out the platform differences and make it much easier.
Yeah, it's always a very popular discussion and topic as far as like React and React Native goes. But you're right, there is the ecosystem that's there right now it's not very good. There's just a lot of things that you can't do without implementing them from scratch.
Yeah, it seems to me that like we've been doing a lot of apps that share code between platforms, and the general impression that I have is that it's sort of tricky and non-trivial to do. That's the first thing, because as Radek mentioned, not many people are sort of reaching into it, and so the entry barrier is pretty high. Like I don't feel like there is a lot of information on what should be shared and how you should do it in order to avoid getting into a maintenance hell. And yeah, it's just my general impression. Maybe we need more time to build some tools and UI kits and general sort of educate people how to do it efficiently. Because when you are working on a product, there is usually a short timeline that you have to comply with in order to deliver your product on time. And sort of making sure your app runs on both web and mobile is just very hard to sort of implement. Yeah, if anyone has any questions regarding this approach, I'll be more than happy to answer them. So you can DM me or tweet me, and I can talk a bit more about that. Maybe another weekend do an episode on that again to go into details on how this could be done or what are the learnings from production.
Yeah, definitely. Like you said, it's not easy. And when you make apps for clients, then you might not be able to justify the time to build this. I think some of it is also because some people don't want, like it really depends on the use case. For some projects, you don't want the same thing as an app and as a web thing. Like you might want to build a different thing for the web, and then sharing might no longer make sense. But we find that For our use cases, and I feel like for a lot of use cases, especially that we have, stuff like Electron and whatnot to package it as Mac, Windows, Linux apps as well, the web app, then this would be very useful for a ton of apps. It's just that, yeah, it needs more infrastructure. And just like React Native is great because a lot of insignificant, like boring differences between iOS and Android are abstracted away, and you have to deal with the real platform differences. So on the web, like the web is a very different platform, but a lot of stuff that you deal with on the web in terms of like layout and just like API differences, it's just that. Like it's the same thing, just a different API, and it just needs an abstraction.
Yeah, that sounds like a good topic. We should actually dedicate another show to that, because it's been a while since we discussed this, and a lot of things have changed, and a lot of things haven't changed since the last time we talked about it. So it might be cool to discuss again. Okay, cool. So let's now get to the picks, I guess. Radek, do you have any picks today?
Right. So I have a podcast on my own, which is called The Podcast, which is a terrible, un-Googleable name. But if you care about like productivity and business and technology, and like we talk about everything, then the podcast.fm.
Okay, can you spell that? Because I'm not sure if you're saying, is it the podcast or the podcast?
No, it's just the podcast, T-H-E.
Oh, okay, the podcast. Okay, cool. I'm going to subscribe. That sounds good. Mike, do you have any picks?
One thing that I could mention is, again, our work with BS React Native, which is the reason the ML way for writing React Native apps. But I'm pretty sure I've already picked that one last week. So rather than that, I don't feel like I have any more updates. I should probably get more prepared for the picks next time.
It's all good. I don't really have that great of picks this week either. Over the weekend, I was playing around with Flutter because I'm doing a couple of videos for Egghead. And I put together a couple of demos using Flutter with Redux. So if you're interested in how to use state management with Redux with Flutter, you go to my GitHub repo, Dabbit3. The two repos that use Flutter both use Redux. So if you're interested in that, check it out. Also, Egghead in general is another pick for me. I have 4 video courses coming out over the next couple of months there. I have one on AWS AppSync. I have one on AWS Amplify. I have one on Flutter, and then I have one on Flutter with Redux. So keep an eye out for those. And Egghead seems to be a pretty cool place to not only learn stuff, but also if you want to make a little money on the side, create some videos, put them up there. You can get a little bit of side income if you choose the paid option. I think also if you don't choose the paid option, you still make some money, but I'm not sure because I'm still kind of new there. So, all right, cool. Well, that wraps up this episode. Radek, thanks for joining us today and taking the time out of your schedule to come hang out.
Thank you so much again for inviting me.
All right, well, that wraps up this episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll see everyone next week.